Good afternoon, Justices. May it please the Court, I'm Daniel Rath, Landis Rath & Cobb, and will be presenting argument on behalf of the appellee, Credit Suisse Securities, LLC, today. With me are Mr. Brian Burns of Duvall & Stackenfeld, who's been admitted pro hoc vice and will make the argument on behalf of the appellee.
Was counsel referring to you?
No, Mr. Brian Burns, yes, sir.
Okay.
And this is Mr. Joshua Klein, also of Duvall & Stackenfeld.
Welcome to the Court.
With the Court's permission, I'd like to also introduce Mr. Jeffrey Drobish, who is also of my firm, Landis Rath & Cobb, and is with us today. He's admitted to the Missouri Bar and pending admission to the Delaware Bar.
I take it that means you've passed the bar exam, just pending the
yes.
Writings?
Here for the Court, Your Honor.
Good luck.
Good afternoon. Dan Reisbach for Appellant West Coast Opportunity Fund. I'd like to introduce those at council table with me, Scott Perkins and Pete Wood from my office.
Welcome.
Thank you for hearing us today. West Coast appeals essentially on three grounds. The primary ground presents a discrete issue. That is, does the phrase directly or indirectly have meaning in the lockup agreement? And if so, does it prohibit Mr. Evans' indirect pledge of shares held through his wholly owned and controlled LLC? The Court of Chancery set the stage for the events on page one of its opinion. First sentence, the Vice Chancellor said, an individual signs a lockup agreement prohibiting him from pledging or otherwise transferring, directly or indirectly, stock in a publicly traded company. We agree completely with that. However, the Court below did not decide that issue. It decided whether or not there was a direct pledge by Mr. Evans, but did not decide whether there was an indirect pledge. We submit that it was error not to so decide, and that the facts of this case and the literal terms of the agreement compel reversal.
Mr. Dreisbach, in the electronic age, how do people have notice of these types of pledges? You know, years ago, when everything was paper, if there was a stock purchase agreement or some type of restriction or a pledge, you'd see it on the piece of paper, and then everyone was on notice that you can't transfer the shares unless you comply with whatever you're reading about. Well, how does that work today?
Your Honor, I don't know how it works generally. I know in this case that we did not know, West Coast did not know, the pledge of shares by Investment Hunter to Credit Suisse. It was a complete surprise to us, and we did not know about that until October of 2008, I believe, when there was an attempted sale by Credit Suisse of those shares.
Well, and how did Credit Suisse know that there had been a prior pledge?
As far as I understand, there's nothing in the record that Credit Suisse also or either knew about the lockup agreement between West Coast and Mr. Evans.
And does this record show what West Coast knew? You know, going back to the days when people had pieces of paper, you would think that, as I understand it, Evans never owned these shares individually, even when he signed the pledge. Is that correct?
As far as we know, Your Honor, the only evidence in the record of Mr. Evans or ownership of the Green Hunter shares is a Form 3 filed in October of 2007, which suggested that all of Mr. Evans' shares of Green Hunter were held through his wholly owned and controlled LLC Investment Hunter.
So at the very beginning of this, you know, you would think someone on behalf of West Coast would say, let me see proof of ownership, wouldn't you?
Your Honor, that certainly would have been a reasonable question to ask at that time. However,
actually, there was a rep and warranty to that effect, though, wasn't there?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so. What my understanding, though, is the lockup agreement had broad enough language to capture not only direct ownership, but also indirect ownership. So it would cover West Coast in the broadest possible way. So Mr. Evans didn't have to make any representations as to exactly how or through whom he owned those shares. This is an unusual case. There are two unrelated parties. West Coast and Credit Suisse have no relationship to each other. They both contracted with Mr. Evans. They both were likely defrauded in this case. And the contracts that West Coast and Credit Suisse had with Mr. Evans provided inconsistent rights with respect to shares of Green Hunter. When Credit Suisse was prevented by the proper application of the lockup agreement from selling those shares, instead of suing Mr. Evans or Investment Hunter, Credit Suisse sued an unrelated third party, West Coast. That's why we're here. So there's contract rights, competing claims of contract rights.
It was impossible to join Mr. Evans in this litigation?
My understanding is the counsel below at argument suggested that Mr. Evans may not be amenable to jurisdiction here in Delaware.
Even, is this a Delaware LLC?
It's a Delaware LLC, Your Honor, which was certainly Investment Hunter could have been brought into the fray, and perhaps through some form of jurisdiction, Mr. Evans might have too, but we were brought in for the appeal, and that was not done in the Court of Chancery. Short background. March of 07, West Coast signed a series of agreements with Green Hunter. Evans was the president, CEO, and chairman of Green Hunter, and also its founder. West Coast ultimately invested over $14 million in Green Hunter. The parties executed registration rights agreements, which required Evans and other executives of Green Hunter to execute these lockup agreements to prevent shares being sold or otherwise transferred. Specifically, on March 9, 2007, Evans executed his lockup agreement with West Coast, wherein he promised not to pledge, directly or indirectly, any shares of Green Hunter stock. It's typical in those types of arrangements that an investor locks up the shares of the founder and CEO of the company. In addition, Mr. Evans provided West Coast with protection over that promise, wherein he consented to the entry of a stock transfer instruction in the event Evans tried to directly or indirectly transfer, pledge, or otherwise sell his shares.
He consented to the entry of a stock transfer instruction by West Coast?
By Green Hunter, Your Honor. By Green Hunter through its transfer agent.
Green Hunter, okay.
Correct. The lockup agreement was an integral part of the investment by West Coast. Indeed, the early language in the agreement provides that it was entered into to induce West Coast to invest in Green Hunter.
So, Dreisbach, do the parties suggest there's any significance to the fact that the lockup agreement, at least as I understand it, says Gary C. Evans and then has his title of chief executive officer without indicating of what he is chief executive officer?
Your Honor, there's some debate about that. For the purposes of our primary argument on appeal, we would concede that it's only Mr. Evans, personally, that's bound by the lockup agreement. We also have some arguments as to why the court does not agree with us. It should remand back to the Court of Chancery for discovery and trial on that issue and others. But for purposes of this argument, we concede that the lockup agreement only binds Mr. Evans personally.
Okay.
We talked a little bit about the Form 3, and again, the only evidence in the record is that Mr. Evans owned his shares at all times through his investment vehicle, Investment Hunter. 16 months after the lockup, July 2008, Evans caused Investment Hunter to enter into a margin account with Credit Suisse. Evans pledged 4,000 shares. The rest is history. Those shares, stock price value plummeted. Credit Suisse tried to sell the shares. A stock transfer order was put in place, preventing them. Suit was filed. Both parties filed cross motions for judgment on the pleadings. As to count one, the parties in the Court of Chancery framed the issue differently. Credit Suisse framed it as, was Investment Hunter expressly bound by the lockup agreement? The court answered that question. West Coast framed the issue as follows. Did Evans' indirect pledge of Green Hunter shares to Credit Suisse violate the lockup agreement? Credit Suisse suggests quite strongly that the court answered West Coast's issue as it framed it. I don't think there can be much disagreement on that, given the opinion at page 10, where the court expressly stated that the court does not need to decide that interpretive issue, and that the court's task was complete once it determined that Investment Hunter was not a signatory to the lockup agreement.
Your position, in so many words, is that as a consequence of the lockup agreement, there was essentially a restriction on transfer against the shares that are the subject of this lawsuit. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And that whether or not Credit Suisse knew about it, and we have to assume here that Credit Suisse did not know that transfer was should be given effect.
Well, that transfer was blocked, correct.
Does the record show, and I may be re-asking in a different way Judge Justice Holland's question, where did the shares that were pledged with Credit Suisse, were they certificated, or was that simply an electronic transfer of some sort?
You know, Honor, I don't know the answer to that question, how that was actually done. Okay. Anyway,
is the analysis, would it be the same in this case if it had been an outright sale?
If Investment Hunter had tried to sell the shares?
Basically just sold for the value of the loan, just sold them to Credit Suisse. Is the analysis the same?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Our position is that Mr. Evans was prohibited from indirectly selling or pledging the shares. So if he tried to sell shares held by Investment Hunter, that would have also been covered by the lockup agreement, and there could have been a stop transfer order put in place to stop that sale.
Is there a concept of good faith purchaser for value or anything of that nature that would basically allow the transaction to go through subject to your client's claim for damages, substantial damages, against Mr. Evans wherever he may be found?
Perhaps, Your Honor, if it went down the line quite a ways, but here, before the pledge or sale was consummated, Credit Suisse was notified of the lockup agreement. So the protections provided to West Coast in the lockup agreement was not only that he's not allowed to do it, but in the event he tries to do it, West Coast was entitled to instruct Green Hunter to put a stop transfer order in place to prevent the sale.
When they got that notification, they were already committed. The margin account had been set up. So I think Justice Ridgely's question is, if you're the equivalent of a good faith purchaser for value at the inception, and you think you have an agreement, but in your case, you're submitting your client had a superseding agreement that was stronger, but Credit Suisse never knew about it until they went to collect. So how does that get sorted out in the law?
Well, the original agreement was a lock agreement between West Coast and Mr. Evans. That agreement not only had rights to prohibit Mr. Evans through himself or an intermediary from doing things, but also gave West Coast the right to stop it in the event he tried. The fact that Credit Suisse came along later and entered into this agreement with Mr. Evans, where Mr. Evans' counsel told Credit Suisse that it was okay, that these shares were freely transferable, that's an action that Credit Suisse, we submit, should have brought against Investment Hunter or
I know
Mr.
That.
Evans.
Let me try my question one more time. When West Coast entered into this agreement, why wasn't it incumbent upon them to somehow make the world aware of the agreement? It's like if you loan someone money, you record a mortgage, there's public notice. If we just stay with that analogy, there's no public notice of this agreement. So someone comes along and buys the house that appears to be mortgage-free because the mortgage is unrecorded, you know, we would say that the person who didn't record their mortgage has a problem. Here, Credit Suisse had no notice until after the fact. So in these commercial transactions, you know, tell us the norm. You have a right, you don't give any public or third-party notice of the right, and then when you find out the person you dealt with, like Evans, has really done something wrong by pledging the shares twice, somehow the third party can't pursue the right you never told them about.
Your Honor, I don't know in a mortgage context or even in the shares if there could or should have been done to put the world or third parties on notice. Obviously, that wasn't done here. Mr. Evans knew about the lockup agreement, knew about the lockup agreement, told his counsel about his lockup agreement. So the fact that Mr. Evans and his counsel entered into this credit agreement with Credit Suisse, margin agreement, sorry, all I can tell you is what happened.
Can I go at it a slightly different
sure.
way? If I understand what's going on here, two different parties, wholly unrelated, both got taken by Mr. Evans. They each entered into agreements that they thought was had protections built in terms of the margin call for purposes of Credit Suisse and in terms of the lockup agreement that you had and the stop purchase ability. So you've got two parties, two arguably innocent parties, who turns out were doing business with somebody who does not appear to be above board. But in any event, now the two innocent parties have to figure out which one of them prevails. And are you saying that you should prevail because your agreement was signed earlier than the Credit Suisse agreement, and it's just a matter of who does something first and that's who wins? Or is there some other reason why your arrangement gets some sort of priority over the Credit Suisse arrangement?
I think it's more than just a temporal argument we're making, and that is that in addition to a prohibition against Mr. Evans directly or indirectly pledging his shares, West Coast bargained for and received the right to stop any transfer.
Okay, so you know, possession is 9/10 of the law, and you know, you got a provision in your arrangement that was very helpful under these circumstances, but that, to me at least, has no bearing on whether you should be entitled to avoid the losses versus Credit Suisse. From what I'm hearing, it still goes back to who signed a contract first.
Well, Your Honor, our contract certainly was in place before Credit Suisse's.
Right. But is there any other reason? And you had this extra protection, which was extra protection, but I don't think that gives you a stronger position other than that you were able to accomplish something. But are we supposed to make a decision based upon who's got the earlier contract?
Well, Your Honor, you certainly could, although I still think that the protection that West Coast bargained for, which was to prevent Mr. Evans from securing or completing a sale or transfer or pledge of shares.
Well, that may be, Mr. Geisbach, but it really brings us back to the line of inquiry that Justice Holland was pursuing. Your client, I guess, was first in time. It got a contractual right to stop any transfer that would result in a sale or a pledge. However, the facts, as they're presented to us, and I guess as the record discloses, shows that later on, another innocent party, Credit Suisse, becomes a pledgee for value, and without notice of your client's prior contract right. The argument that suggests itself is that at that moment in time, the bank, Credit Suisse, became a bona fide pledgee for value. And like a bona fide purchaser for value, that cuts off all outstanding equities. Why does that proposition, well, number one, how does that proposition fit in to the legal analysis in that case, and why isn't that a complete answer to the argument you're making?
Your Honor, it's certainly not an argument that we've faced or by Credit Suisse, and I'm not sure I have a good enough answer for you.
It's not before us. Is that, I mean, that's your argument?
Well, I think that's certainly part of it, but I'm not sure I have a good answer to your question, however. If I may just continue on, with the lockup agreement, the words provide, I think, complete relief to West Coast, which is to induce the buyers, West Coast, to enter into the proposed transaction with the company Green Hunter. The undersigned hereby agrees that he will not pledge, sell, otherwise transfer, dispose of, directly or indirectly, any shares of common stock. Our position is that language is clear, that Mr. Evans promised that he would not pledge directly by himself or indirectly through the use of any intermediary. There's been some briefing on the intermediary. What does that cover? Credit Suisse doesn't have an answer for what directly or indirectly does in the contract itself. It says that it modifies the last forbidden act, which is otherwise transfer or dispose of. even though or otherwise transferred dispose of, is itself a catch-all. They have yet to come up with what directly or indirectly does to modify that catch-all itself. We think it would be redundant if that's the way it was read and render indirectly or directly a nullity.
Let me see if I have your position right. This may be the answer to my earlier question. The part of the problem here is the very odd procedural context in which this whole issue comes up. Again, your client had an equity. That is, it had a contract right to stop any sale or any pledge. It exercised that contract right, even though at the time of the pledge, Credit Suisse, let's assume, did not have any knowledge. It may be that Credit Suisse can make the argument that it was a bona fide of a pledgee without notice, but that's an issue to be resolved later in the case. It's not before us now, and it wasn't before the Vice Chancellor. Therefore, the only issue is whether or not your contract right attached by virtue of the term directly or indirectly, then you should win. At least to get beyond the motion to dismiss stage.
That's correct, Your Honor. There was no discovery below. It was just motion for judgment on the pleadings based upon the complaint and answer. So there's nothing in the record as to whether or not Credit Suisse knew about the lockup agreement or whether West Coast knew about the pledge. So that's not before us.
When the Court of Chancery decided to rule the other way, it said Investment Hunter didn't sign the agreement, so we're not going to enforce it against them. Your response was, Evans agreed not to do it directly or indirectly. He's done it through Investment Hunter, and your client's entitled to relief.
Correct, Your Honor. If I can save the remainder of my time for a rebuttal.
Okay.
May it please the Court, Brian Burns of Duvall and Stackenfeld on behalf of Credit Suisse Securities USA, LLC. Based on the questionings that I just heard from the Court, I think there's a basic issue which may be helpful in terms of resolving this appeal. There are two separate contracts at issue here. Credit Suisse did not enter into a contract with Mr. Evans. Credit Suisse entered into a contract with Investment Hunter, whereas West Coast entered into a contract with Mr. Evans. For purposes of the declaratory judgment claim, which is the claim under appeal, the fact that Investment Hunter did not enter into a direct contract with West Coast is dispositive. Investment Hunter opened a margin account with Credit Suisse, and Investment Hunter pledged the Green Hunter stock as collateral when it opened that account, and then West Coast attempted to block the sale of those shares. In the complaint, Credit Suisse seeks a judgment concerning West Coast's ability to block the shares by Investment Hunter. And because Investment Hunter did not sign the lockup agreement and is mentioned nowhere in the lockup agreement, we submit to the Court that Investment Hunter cannot be bound by the lockup agreement. So with respect to the question of whether it's a temporal issue or why should Credit Suisse take priority over West Coast in this instance, we maintain that it's a matter of contract law that a non-signatory cannot be bound to a contract unless it, well, except for in certain limited circumstances, which do not apply here.
Is that the right analysis, though? Isn't the issue whether the shares are bound by the agreement that was made with West Coast, the agreement that Evans made with West Coast, not whether his wholly owned and controlled subsidiary was bound?
Well, as Vice Chancellor Noble held, the shares of Green Hunter stock, which are held by Investment Hunter, are not the property, are not Evans's property. Investment Hunter, as a separate limited liability company, is treated separately. And therefore, if West Coast wanted to lock up those shares, it had an obligation to sign an agreement with Investment Hunter, and that's what it did not do. In the declaratory judgment claim, a judgment is sought with respect to what was termed the pledged shares, and those are shares which were pledged by Investment Hunter. Vice Chancellor Noble held that Evans has no right to those particular shares. So we maintain that the critical distinction is the fact that Investment Hunter cannot be bound to a contract that it did not sign, well, that it is not mentioned in.
Evans is the ultimate owner of those shares, of the subject shares, because he owned 100% of Investment Hunter, which owned, I assume, 100% had an equity, full equity interest in the shares that were pledged. Correct.
That's correct. He is the ultimate right. owner.
So the way the argument would go is that the shares themselves were subject to an equitable restraint imposed by contract that had been agreed to by the ultimate owner, who had 100% control and power over the title holder, which happened to be Investment Hunter. What's the flaw in that argument?
Well, the flaw in that argument is, Investment Hunter, under the limited liability company law of Delaware, Investment Hunter is treated as a separate entity, and the fact that Evans is the sole member and owner of Investment Hunter does not give him a personal interest in the shares held by Investment Hunter?
Let me say it differently. It may be in the abstract that as a separate entity, Investment Hunter was not contractually bound, except for one thing, and that is that the owner and controller of Investment Hunter bound it.
Well,
by virtue of the contract that it entered into with West Coast.
Well, we maintain, Your Honor, that if West Coast intended to bind Investment Hunter to the lockup agreement, it would have to have Investment Hunter sign the lockup agreement as well, or clearly indicate on the face of the agreement that Investment Hunter would be bound.
And what is the basis for that statement?
The basis is under Texas contract law, as well as Delaware law, non-signatories are typically not bound to contracts, and there are only a limited number of exceptions where that does not apply.
Yes, but we also have a rule in Delaware that the corporate veil can be pierced. When the corporation is used as a vehicle in contravention to contravene contract rights, as well as a fraud, why doesn't that defeat your argument, assuming that the facts could be made out at a later stage?
Well, Your Honor, there in the court below, there was discussion about a potential alter ego theory.
About alter ego. I'm talking about the piercing the corporate veil.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was referred to as alter ego, but there was reference made to a potential piercing the corporate veil. And under the law of Delaware, a party is entitled to pierce the corporate veil only if it can show that the corporate structure was set up so as to cause a fraud upon it. That does not apply in this case.
Actually, that's not correct. Fraud is one example. Contravention of contract is another, and public wrong is a third.
Okay, Your Honor, I stand corrected. The reason these equitable arguments would not apply here in our submission is because West Coast never had any relationship with Investment Hunter. West Coast, as far as the record shows,
had no idea that Investment Hunter existed because Evans never told them.
Well,
Correct. I mean, just like Evans never told, I mean, we have to assume Credit Suisse about the lockup agreement.
Well, we don't know what Evans may have told West Coast or not. However, in order to pierce the corporate veil, we submit that there would have to be some sort of fraud or contravention of contract based on something done by Investment Hunter, whereas the record here shows that there was no relationship. And Vice Chancellor Noble did address this notion of a good faith purchaser, and in his analysis, which we maintain is correct, there was no basis for this kind of an equitable claim because there's no evidence that Credit Suisse had any prior knowledge whatsoever, so therefore there would be no basis for West Coast to invoke this kind of equitable theory against Credit Suisse.
But there was no adjudication by the Vice Chancellor that Credit Suisse was a bona fide pledgee for value without notice, was there?
In the court below, West Coast did raise these arguments. But
it wasn't determined.
And in its papers on appeal, West Coast has raised these arguments as well, claiming that there is a material issue of fact that needs to be addressed. We maintain that these equitable arguments have no place because there's no evidence suggesting that West Coast would have could have relied on anything done by Investment Hunter by virtue of the fact that it never had any relationship with Investment
Hunter. Well, the beginning and the end of your argument is that as a matter of law, unless Investment Hunter is contractually bound, in this case by the lockup agreement, then neither that entity nor the shares to which it holds title are restrained in any way by the lockup agreement.
Our argument is that the shares that were pledged to Credit Suisse were shares owned by Investment Hunter. And as a matter of contract law, Investment Hunter cannot be bound to a lockup agreement that it did not sign and that where it is mentioned nowhere in the agreement because Texas law does not permit a party to be bound by implication. And the argument here is that the words directly or indirectly by implication could bind a third party like Investment Hunter. We have submitted case law from Texas and Delaware stating that as a matter of contract law, a third party cannot be bound to an agreement unless it is clearly specified on the face of the agreement. And that did not occur here.
Well, let me ask you a kind of a basic question. How did West Coast get the power to stop the transfer if there was no involvement by Investment Hunter?
There was a question earlier about whether there were physical certificates, and in fact there were physical certificates. And when Credit Suisse attempted to sell the shares, the Green Hunter General Counsel informed Credit Suisse for the first time of the lockup agreement. So this was taking place in October of 2008.
So Green Hunter had some knowledge of the lockup agreement?
Presumably. It was only at that time when Credit Suisse was attempting to sell the shares. West Coast is a principal investor in Green Hunter, and Green Hunter's general counsel is the one who wrote a letter to Credit Suisse informing them of the lockup agreement.
Just to clarify, you're in response to your question to our Justice Berger's question, you're saying there were physical certificates that represented the shares that were pledged?
Correct.
And they were transferred to Credit Suisse's pledgee?
Credit Suisse had a physical certificate. Right. Which it received in connection with the pledge when the pledge was made in the summer of 2008.
Right.
And it transferred those physical certificates, which were restricted. They were subject to, I believe it was Rule 144A restrictions. And at that time, Green Hunter's general counsel, who, just incidentally, had previously informed Credit Suisse that the shares were freely transferable, raised the lockup agreement.
Just to reiterate one question that Justice Holland alluded to or asked earlier, the physical certificate, did it have on its face a legend that the transfer was restricted not only by Rule 144, but also by virtue of the lockup agreement?
No, absolutely not. In fact, Credit Suisse did its due diligence and obtained an opinion from the Green Hunter General Counsel stating that the shares were freely transferable and not subject to any restrictions. So absolutely
what
not.
What was the basis for him subsequently changing his opinion or her opinion?
The reason given in the letter was that West Coast, a principal investor of Green Hunter, has objected to the transfer and has certain rights under the lockup agreement.
But you would have thought that would have been mentioned in the first letter.
Well, I'm sorry, the first letter being the pledge over the summer?
Right.
There was no reference whatsoever to the lockup agreement
at
that time.
I thought you said the attorney for Green Hunter said the shares were not restricted and freely transferable initially.
That's correct.
When you entered into the agreement.
That's right.
So that was wrong.
Yes, absolutely. In our opinion, yes. That was wrong, and we did not learn about, Credit Suisse did not learn about the lockup agreement until the time it was attempting to liquidate the collateral.
Do you know who that counsel was?
Yes, Morgan Johnston. Just to turn to the contract argument, there is law in Texas and in Delaware delineating the very few circumstances in which a non-signatory can be bound to the contract, and we have submitted in our papers that none of those exceptions are applicable here, mainly because Investment Hunter is not mentioned anywhere in the agreement, and nor can Investment Hunter be bound when the lockup agreement itself shows that Gary Evans is undertaking commitments in his personal capacity. So under these circumstances, the lockup agreement cannot apply to a third party, and under Delaware limited liability company law, Investment Hunter is treated as a third party, you know, notwithstanding the fact that Evans is its owner and manager.
Well, even irrelevancy needs to be consistent. So having you made that statement, what is the significance, if any, that when Gary C. Evans signed this lockup agreement, he has a title called Chief Executive Officer, but no entity of which he's chief executive officer is identified?
Well, Your Honor, there is a concept known as descripto personae, where when a title is indicated beneath a signature, that title can be treated as merely descriptive and not be binding or an indication that the individual was signing in that particular capacity. Because the lockup agreement shows that Mr. Evans was making commitments in his personal capacity, we believe that the title Chief Executive Officer should be treated as descripto personae. The record
he's
also
describing himself individually as what, CEO of himself?
Well, no. I think under the concept of descripto personae, the title is merely identifying that he is the CEO, but does not mean that he is undertaking his commitments in his capacity as chief executive officer, which would not make any sense because the lockup agreement itself identifies Green Hunter as the company.
But identifying himself as the chief executive officer of an unnamed company which wasn't contracting with West Coast doesn't make any sense either.
Right. That's why courts will treat that as simply descriptive and does not change the capacity in which he was signing.
What was Evan's position with regard to Green Hunter?
Chief executive officer. And the record shows that West Coast entered into similar lockup agreements with the other executives of Green Hunter. So therefore, it appears as though he was simply indicating that he is the chief executive officer, even though West Coast intended to lock him up from making sales of the Green Hunter stock during the period specified in the lockup agreement.
And I noticed that Morgan Johnston, I assume the same Morgan Johnston, who was counsel, also executed one of those lockup agreements.
Correct.
So the same counsel who advised you that there were no restrictions had actually signed a lockup agreement.
That's correct. I believe there were about five executives, that West Coast and Green Hunter executives who signed with West Coast. In the papers, there also is there are some public policy arguments which are posited that I just wanted to address briefly. There is a claim that the Vice Chancellor's opinion should be reversed because otherwise it would allow an individual to evade contractual commitments by simply having a wholly owned limited liability company carry out the very act which he agreed not to commit. We submit that issue was not addressed by Vice Chancellor Noble in his opinion. Because the declaratory judgment claim concerns restrictions on investment Hunter or the lack thereof, there was no opinion issued with respect to whether Evans breached his commitments to West Coast or not. So that simply, we would submit that there can be no problematic public policy issue because that's not consistent with the opinion issued by the court.
Well, in talking about things that weren't addressed, help us understand the record. And we asked a lot of questions that seemed to suggest that your client looked like a good faith pledgee for value without notice of the prior restriction. Is that something that was raised, or was your exclusive focus on the fact that Investment Hunter didn't sign the agreement? And so stated a different way, did you argue this in the alternative and the Vice Chancellor picked one, or you just never made the argument?
We did make the argument, mainly because after the first round of briefs were submitted, West Coast raised certain equitable arguments, and the court addressed these arguments by exactly saying that Credit Suisse was in a position that was akin to a good faith purchaser for value, so therefore West Coast would not have an ability to invoke equity against Credit Suisse, given that Credit Suisse acted in good faith based on the record before it. So
why wasn't that the end of the case?
Well, the Vice Chancellor also ruled on the contractual grounds, and based on the issue framed by the declaratory judgment claim, the Vice Chancellor found that there was no basis to find that Investment Hunter could be bound to the lockup agreement. So both, after reaching both of those findings, the court entered judgment for Credit Suisse.
Well, if Investment Hunter, couldn't all of Evans' knowledge be imputed to Investment Hunter?
Well, Evans's knowledge perhaps could be imputed to Investment Hunter, and certainly West Coast.
And wouldn't that, at least as to Investment Hunter, provide some basis for equitable relief?
I think that would provide basis for West Coast to bring a claim against Evans for either defrauding it or for breaching his commitments to it. But Investment Hunter itself had nothing to do with West Coast, and so therefore, as a matter of contract law, West Coast has no ability to impede Investment Hunter from selling its shares to Credit Suisse consistent with its commitments in the margin agreement.
I was a little confused by your response to Justice Holland's last question. I understand that your client made the bona fide pledgee without notice argument in the Court of Chancery.
Right.
And it's undisputed that the Court of Chancery ruled in your client's favor on the basis that Investment Hunter was not contractually bound by the lockup agreement. But your response to Justice Holland's question suggests, and I may have heard it wrong, that the court also ruled in the alternative that in any event, Credit Suisse was a bona fide pledgee for value. Is that right or not?
I'm sorry. Perhaps I was not clear. The court ruled on the contract issue, as you have stated, and then in a footnote, the court addressed the equitable arguments.
When you say addressed, meaning did it rule or did it just talk about it?
I think it did rule because those arguments were made by West Coast below, and the court denied those arguments based on its comment in the footnote. That would be footnote 23, which appears on page 9.
And what does the court say?
The court says, I'll just read briefly here. West Coast argues at some length that Investment Hunter should be viewed as the alter ego of Evans, and Investment Hunter should be equitably stopped from pledging its shares of Green Hunter. And then there's some discussion, and the court ultimately finds, and I have to admit I haven't studied this particular footnote, but the thrust of the court's decision was that because Credit Suisse was a purchaser in good faith, this is certainly during the statement at oral argument, and I believe it is it's embodied in that footnote as well, although I don't want to get too...
Well, if that was an alternative ruling, you would think that your brief would display that front and center as an alternative argument, and I don't see it.
That is addressed in our brief. It's in the third section.
All the third section argues is that there were no material facts. It's a rather strange way to present what would otherwise seem to be a very straightforward BFP argument.
Well, I believe that West Coast, and I apologize if I have not been clear on this, but West Coast was making an argument based on alter ego, but it was in support of its argument that there were material facts that needed to be resolved. So that's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
I can be brief. What was interesting is my new friend did not deal with the indirect argument from the lockup agreement. Focused instead solely on Investment Hunter and whether Investment Hunter was bound by the lockup agreement. They haven't met us face on to date on whether or not Mr. Evans could indirectly pledge his shares through Investment Hunter.
Well, now that we know these were really paper certificates, one still has to wonder why West Coast didn't put some type of legend on the piece of paper.
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that, and I haven't seen the certificates. They are not in the record. So I don't know exactly what they say. I take it at face value, what Mr. Byrne said, but I don't know and can't answer why West Coast did not put something on those certificates.
Your new friend's point about a Delaware LLC being a distinct entity from the sole investor in that LLC as a person, does that have any significance to your indirect argument?
No, Your Honor. It's still Mr. Evans is causing. He's a sole manager, sole member. There are no other employees, Investment Hunter. He's the only one that can have Investment Hunter do anything. As the Vice Chancellor noted in his opinion, entities act through individuals. The only individual at Investment Hunter was Mr. Evans. I think there's even an argument we could make that Mr. Evans, by causing Investment Hunter to pledge those shares, did it directly. Our argument in our briefs is more for indirectly, but I think there's a good faith argument we could make that he did so directly. Our point, Your Honors, is that the court below should be reversed because it failed to address our argument. Whether or not Investment Hunter was bound by the lockup agreement is really of no moment to us and we believe we can win because Mr. Evans contracted with us to not indirectly sell or pledge shares as well. So we believe, based upon the literal language of the agreement based upon the Shenandoah case by former Chancellor Allen, where he said that you can't use, interpreting the term indirectly, you can't use a subsidiary to do something that you've contracted not to do yourself when you've also agreed not to do something indirectly. Your Honor, that's all I have. We certainly rest for our final two arguments on our papers, unless you have some questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.